Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Meeting House, where we have conversation on religion and American life. I'm your host, Dr. Dwight A. Moody, coming to you over Rejoice975.com from the Golden Isles of Georgia. Summer is here in Brunswick and on St. Simon's, Jekyll, and Sea Islands. It's a good place to be. If you're going to have to stay home, as we all should be staying home these days, this is not a bad place to stay home. Thank you for joining our conversation. As always, week by week, I will have five news stories from the world of religion in America. We have some really inspirational and wonderful music today. And then I have a guest who is coming to us from Austin, Texas, the greater Austin, Texas area, Dr. Nap Nasworth. We're going to talk about religion and American life. He's a scholar in that field. We're going to talk about that. Welcome to the Meeting House, Dr. Nasworth.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. I look forward to our conversation. You're interested in exactly what we're interested in, and we'll talk about it. But now, the news. From Evanston, Illinois, Garrett Theological Seminary joined a growing list of schools naming, for the first time, a person of color as their lead executive. Javier A. Vieira, a native of Puerto Rico, was named president of this United Methodist school. Other new presidents include Barbara Holmes at the United Theological Seminary in Ohio and Angela D. Sims at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, and a couple of deans, people of color. Kelly Brown Douglas is the dean at Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary in New York. Valerie Bridgman is dean of the Methodist Theological School in Ohio. From Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court decided an important case declaring unconstitutional a Montana law that barred states from spending tax money to support students at religious schools if, at the same time, they provide similar help to other students in private schools that are non-religious. The 5-4 decision, penned by Chief Justice John Roberts and joined by the four other conservative justices, making it, by the way, an all-Catholic decision, broke more than a century of tradition and opens the door to the tax support of religious schools throughout the nation. Religious organizations cannot be denied public support just because they are religious in nature. Also from Washington, D.C., American Christians are very reluctant to return to public communal worship. According to a new study by the conservative American Enterprise Institute, they surveyed 3,504 persons 1 month ago, showing that 2/3 of those interviewed were somewhat uncomfortable or very uncomfortable in returning to worship. And more than half of the people whose churches have restarted worship have chosen not to attend. The only group that deviated from this national norm were, surprise, white evangelicals. 61% of them, especially the men, expressed strong confidence or some confidence in returning to worship. And in Chicago, another research, Christianity Today reports the findings of social scientists associated with the Religion in Public platform that a strong majority of American evangelicals support a much more prominent role for women in the church, including as teachers and preachers. This confirms earlier data reported that almost a decade ago by the Barna Group. While evangelical leaders have been sparring over this trend, engaging such people as Beth Moore, John MacArthur, and Albert Mohler, the people in the pew have been quietly moving in the direction of more acceptance of female leadership. While as many as 90% favor a wide range of platform roles, more than 70% support women as Sunday morning preachers. Currently, 9% of evangelical pastors are women, up from 3% in 1992. And finally, in Indianapolis, on a more personal note, I report the passing of Dr. John R. Wimmer, a program director in the Religion Division of the Lilly Endowment of Indianapolis. Dr. Wimmer, an ordained United Methodist pastor with a Ph.D. from the University of Chicago, was responsible for distributing, over a period of almost 20 years, more than $500 million in grants to religious organizations around the country. Before his tenure with the endowment, Wimmer was on the faculty and administration of the University of Indianapolis and later launched the Center for Congregations, also in Indianapolis. Wimmer died at the age of 63 after a long battle with cancer. That's the news. I will be back in just a minute with Dr. Nap Nasworth, but here first is Kirk Franklin with his 2017 song, My World Needs You.
Show me your face, fill up this space, my world needs you right now, my world needs you right now. I can't escape being afraid, fill me with you. My world needs you right now.
Show me your face, fill up this space. My world needs you right now. My world needs you right now. I can't escape.
Listening to The Meeting House. I'm your host, Dwight Moody, broadcasting from the Golden Isles of Georgia, actually from Brunswick, Georgia. And that was the Kirk Franklin singing his very timely song, My World Needs You. It is the soundtrack of a video that I posted on my website, themeetinghouse.net. And it's the video is a three-minute bike ride from downtown Brunswick to the housing community known as Satilla Shores. It was recorded, edited, and posted by my good friend Jim Jenkins. Satilla Shores is where Ahmaud Arbery was murdered on February 23 of this year. That was the event that lit the fuse that burned through Louisville and New York all the way to Minneapolis, where it exploded into a worldwide movement of racial solidarity and social justice. I encourage you to watch this video. Jim has it on his Facebook page. I put it on my Facebook page. It has been shared more than 200 times already in just a couple of days, viewed 7.1 thousand times. And you can go to themeetinghouse.net and watch this video. It's very, very powerful. I encourage you to do that. Now my guest, Dr. Nap Nasworth, a PhD from the University of Florida in political science. Tell us how you got interested in religion and American life and politics.
Well, I've always sort of been interested in both. I became a Christian in my senior year of high school. That was also the first year I was able to vote. And this was 1988. And of course, 1992 had that very sort of Christian right vibe to it at the Republican convention. So I think, you know, early on, I was very interested in sort of how my faith related to my politics, and then eventually ended up getting a master's degree that related to religion and politics. And then I wanted to specialize in religion and politics, and that's why I went to the University of Florida, because Dr. Ken Wald was there, who was one of the leading experts in that area. And so I went there to study under him.
And your dissertation, tell us about that.
So my dissertation was the institutionalization of the Christian right. And so I went out and I interviewed a lot of different Christian right groups in Washington, D.C.
Like what groups are you talking about?
Concerned Women for America, Family Research Council. I think there was about eight to 10 of them at the time. And most of them are still around today. And the conclusion of my dissertation was that one of the strengths of the Christian right, one of the reasons they were able to have some political success, was that they were like a social movement, and that they were able to work together, even though they all sort of represented different aspects of conservative Christianity. They were able to sort of punch above their weight because of their ability to work together and to maintain these social networks that kept them more as a cohesive unit working together on their shared political goals.
Wow. Of course, they have focused for a long time on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And every election cycle, it's judges, judges, judges. And already that rhetoric is picking up again. Their conviction is that they can restore the country or make the country what they want it to be by appointing the right judges. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
They focused, of course, on Roe v. Wade. That was decided in 1973, if I remember right. There were six justices on the court appointed by Republican presidents and three by Democratic presidents. But five of those Republican justices voted for the right to privacy, which was the basis of the right to an abortion. Since then, 14 other justices have been confirmed, 11 nominated by Republican presidents and only four by Democrats. But still, 50 years later almost, Roe v. Wade survives. Last month, in a 5-4 decision, they struck down restrictions on abortion in Louisiana. Do you think Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned?
I'm less optimistic today because of that case that you just mentioned. I used to think Roberts would vote in favor of overturning Roe v. Wade, but these days I'm not so sure, because Roberts, he seems to want to come up with reasoning in order to avoid controversial decisions.
Yes, I think that's true across the board.
His Obamacare decisions are similar as well. So, of course, overturning Roe v. Wade, nothing would be more controversial from the Supreme Court. So I used to be more optimistic, and now I'm more pessimistic that at least the current court would overturn Roe v. Wade. But ultimately, I think the court will follow public opinion in the long run. The Supreme Court, tends to be slower to respond to public opinion than the other two branches, and it was designed that way. But so what that ultimately means for pro-lifers is that your focus should not be so much on getting appointments to the Supreme Court. It should be on persuasion and persuading the public of your point of views. That's where the main focus should be. And then if you do that, then the Supreme Court will follow.
I concur with you 100%, especially about John Roberts, that he finds odd ways, reasonings to get the result he wants. And the result he wants is to avoid these huge controversial decisions. The decisions this year, some have swung to the right and some have swung to the left. This case out here in Montana about the religious schools is really a big case. Favors the religious right as well as Roman Catholic schools. So who knows? But I agree with you that the conservatives are putting too much confidence in the Supreme Court to get the cultural outcomes they want, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. And I think definitely, the last couple months have really put an exclamation point on that fact.
Yeah, so all these justices and judges that Trump has appointed and the Senate has confirmed over the last 3 years is born out of this conviction that if we can just get more of our kind of judges up there. But so far, not so much. Now, we'll see whether these appellate judges prove both of us wrong, but can President Trump take the conservatives where they want to go?
Well, President Trump's not a conservative, so I doubt that he's going to be able to take them where he
wants. I agree with you on that, too.
His incompetence has just made it horrible for, anyone who claims to be conservative and supports him. And it's just destroyed the Republican Party, and he's just taken everyone down with him.
So what do you mean he's incompetent?
Well, I think this year especially, we've seen two major areas. One is with the protests over and on the issues of race and racism. And the other one is his response to the coronavirus, which has just been a disaster. And we've seen the incompetence from the top is why it's been so hard to get a handle on this coronavirus, and why the U.S. is leading the world in cases and doing so much worse than all the rest of the world.
Amen, brother. You're over there in Texas where things are out of control. We're in Georgia where things are almost out of control. We're just an hour's drive from Florida where things are really out of control. Dr. Fauci said this week, 100,000 cases, new cases a day is not inconceivable. Because of his inability to prepare the country, lead the country through this, how do we explain the fact that the conservatives still support him?
Well, it's sort of a groupthink mentality. I mean, we know this from social sciences that the human brain, we tend to be very groupish, group-oriented. And when we join a certain team and we root for that team, it's hard for us to sort of see things from another viewpoint and so forth. You know, add to that, the way that the media now has become so siloed into different viewpoints where people, if they want to just go online and get news that confirms their biases, there's ways to do that. There's ways to avoid information that challenge your viewpoints. And so people aren't really, you know, getting a wide variety of viewpoints. And so it leads to that sort of very siloed, groupish mentality.
I asked you a minute ago whether Trump can take the conservatives, the Republicans, where they want to go. And you said he wasn't a real conservative and or a real Republican. And I agree with you on both of those fronts. But he's functioning right now as their public leader. But where is it that the conservative movement wants to go these days? How would you summarize what they want?
So as far as like some of the conservatives that I'm talking to, who are people who are not supporting Trump, but who want to, who are already starting to think about, well, what the conservative movement post-Trump is going to be like, right? There's already a lot of thinking and writing and so forth in this area, because there is an agreement that Trump, you know, when he did his sort of hostile takeover of the Republican Party, I think it's partly due to the response that due to the fact that the conservative movement was just such a mess and the Republican Party was such a mess by that time as well, and not really doing a good job of coming up with answers to the problems people are facing today, and particularly when it comes to the working class. And so, you know, you have conservatives who are now saying, all right, well, how do you build a movement that has sort of more of a focus on how do we have a country for the working class and policies that help the working class, people who are really struggling today, and do that from a conservative viewpoint.
Now, you know, I've never heard anybody say what you just said. Do you consider yourself part of the conservative movement?
Yes. I identify as a true conservative, not a Trump conservative. You know, what some people, you know, conservatism is an ideology. It's a way of thinking about what the proper role of government should be. So, but mostly what people, when we talk about conservatism today, it's not really ideological. It's just sort of a cultural identity. You know, I'm a conservative because I watch NASCAR and I drive a pickup truck or what, you know, whatever it is. And so that's what conservatism has become in the minds of many people.
And so what are the issues? I think this is a really good focal point to try to distinguish between what Trump is trying to do versus what the real conservative movement wants. And we'll get back to we'll come back in a minute to, well, if that's where they want to go, why are they so tied up with Trump? What is it that you think the conservative movement in America wants?
Yeah. So again, it's which part are you talking about? Ideological conservatism?
Well, let's
or
just
cultural
talk about
conservatism.
you've been a principal spokesperson, a journalist, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, on a very important platform. What is your vision for America as a conservative?
Well, you know, I prefer smaller government. I prefer less regulation. You know, building a wall on the southern border is not small government. That's big government conservatism. It's not something I support. Conservatives should not be opposed to immigration. You know, we prefer freedom, you know, having a free but ordered society. And so that means allowing immigration in an orderly way. You know, giving more power to local communities, less power, less top-down regulation, you know, less of this notion that, you know, some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. can decide for every school district or every local community what's best for them. No, let's have local communities make decisions for the most part and just have the federal government be an aid in that.
But here's my question about that. What we have seen around the country is that rhetoric, but we've also seen Republican governors pass laws, state legislators pass laws that prevent local cities and communities from taking initiative and governing themselves and making decisions and responding to their needs. It's as if the Republicans are saying, or the conservatives are saying, Washington, we don't want you telling Austin, Texas, or telling Fort Worth, Texas, what to do. But those of us in Austin are going to tell Fort Worth what they can and cannot do. Am I right about this? I mean, Texas itself has done that.
I'm sorry, who?
Texas has done this.
Well, now in Texas, the governor has allowed local, at the county level, to make a lot of these decisions regarding when to close the bars and mask wearing. That's not 100%. There's been some cases where he did make a statewide order at one point. So it's been a little bit of both. Of course, I have to tell you, the pandemic, it presents a particular challenge if you're conservative, right? Because and believe in, you know, sort of local control and regulation, because the coronavirus doesn't recognize state borders. You know, someone can just go across the border and spread it to some other community that has different regulations. So I'll admit this is a particular challenge for conservatives. And I think conservative thinkers will be thinking, you know, long and hard about what their response should be for this pandemic and future pandemics, which we most certainly will have more in the future.
Yes, you criticized Trump a minute ago because he wasn't taking more action. And I think we all recognize, or at least everybody but the president recognizes, that what we need is federal leadership on this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Not only the wearing of masks, but setting standards and setting rules for interstate commerce and interstate travel. So I think you're right. The role of the federal government, we need a bigger role for the federal government in this, and this is a real challenge to the whole conservative movement, isn't it?
Right, and certainly there's a major role for the federal government. You know, the federal government is responsible for our borders, for instance, and so making sure that it's not spread either from us outside the border or from outside the border into the U.S. and so forth. So there's definitely lots of roles that the federal government can play. And just as far as coordination, I mean, we saw so much chaos under Trump where the governors are having to buy supplies and like guard them with their National Guard, you know, from the federal government. That's, you know, this is just sort of the chaotic mismanagement that we've seen under Trump, and it just shows his incompetence to govern.
I want to come back after we take a short break. I want to ask you this question. I'm going to give you a few minutes to think about it. You said a minute ago that you favor smaller government. And that's the rhetoric that the conservatives use. I would like, when we come back, for you to name three or four or five things that the federal government does for you that you're willing to give up, or that any government does for you that you are willing to give up. I want you to think about that, not what the government does for somebody else, but what the government does for you. We're going to come back in just a minute talk to Dr. Nasworth about the current state of religion and politics in America. You're listening to The Meeting House, where we have conversation on religion and American life. I'm your host, Dwight Moody. Here is another hymn. We played one last week. Another hymn of the great Fanny Crosby, who was born 200 years ago, 1820. Her music, as you will recognize, shaped my spiritual journey and the experience of millions of American evangelical Christians. Here is the song, one of my favorites, Rescue the Perishing, sung a cappella by the Altar of Praise Chorale, recorded in 2014 in their studios in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Snatch them in pity from sin and the grave. Weep o'er the erring one, lift up the fallen. Tell them of Jesus the mighty to save. Rescue the perishing.
Jesus is merciful, Jesus will save. Down in the human heart, crushed by the tempter, feelings lie buried that grace can restore. Touched by a loving heart, wakened by kindness, cords that were broken will vibrate once more. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Jesus is merciful.
That is the Altar of Praise Chorale singing the old Fanny Crosby hymn, Rescue the Perishing. It's the 200th anniversary of the birth of Fanny Crosby, one of the great hymn writers of gospel music. I especially like that third verse, down in the human heart, crushed by the tempter, feelings lie buried that grace can restore. Touched by a loving heart, wakened by kindness, chords that are broken will vibrate once more. I love that text. Thank you for joining us in the Meeting House today, coming to you from Brunswick, Georgia. I'm your host, Dwight Moody. My guest is Dr. Nap Nasworth, coming to us from Austin, Texas. Although he's a native of my part of the country over here, South Georgia and Florida, I suppose you know that hymn, Rescue the Perishing. Did you sing that hymn growing up?
Probably. I didn't have a strong church background growing up. I would only go, like when we visit our grandparents most of the time. And so I probably did hear it at my grandparents' church, but, you know, I wasn't a strong church attendee growing up. No.
You said you became a Christian when you were a high school senior.
Right.
Tell us how that happened. Was that girl was involved?
What's that?
Was a girl involved?
No. It was at a Young Life summer camp,
sure.
Actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For almost... So my question to you, just before we took the break, was name some things... You're for smaller government. Name some things right. that you get from the government that you're willing to give up.
Sure. And so the three things I'm going to name are going to have a common theme.
Okay.
And that is the problem of the U.S. national debt. So I have here, I'm looking at the U.S. debt clock. Currently, it's at $26,473 billion plus is our U.S. national debt. Two of the biggest drivers of that debt are Social Security and Medicare. So these are two programs that are unsustainable for the future, and so they need to be completely reformed and make them in a way that's not burdening future generations with debt that they will then be be so burdened with this debt that they will be unable to respond to crises that come their way. This is, I think this is just a huge sin, a huge problem that we're passing on this burden to our children and our grandchildren. So those two, and then another big driver of our debt is defense spending. So of course, we get huge benefits from having the national defense. We have safety and security because of our U.S. military. But the amount of money we're spending on defense is just way over the top. They're spending money on things that we don't need. And I think we can do a lot of reforms in the area of defense spending as well.
Now, I'll have to push back on this. I'm going to assume for a minute that you are not on Social Security and not covered by Medicare.
No, but I pay into it, and so I'll
but you're not a recipient
from it from my retire. Right.
And I'm speaking to you as a person who gets a Social Security check every month and carries the golden card of Medicare. I suspect your feelings about this may change when you get a little older, my friend. But see, there you are. What you're wanting to do is identify things that other people are getting, because you're not getting those services right now. Am I not right?
So any reform that we do for Social Security and Medicare should not impact its current recipients, but we can do this in a way that, because the problem isn't so, the problem is that the growth is the growth in the spending is unsustainable.
Yeah.
So the programs need to, we need to slow down the growth in spending. And then as long as we have a strong economy, then that we'll be able to lower the national debt. But the way that those two programs are currently working is just unsustainable. They're going to collapse no matter what. So the issue is, the sooner we deal with it, the less painful it will be.
Well, as long as it doesn't collapse before I die, I don't know how much longer you have before you can get Social Security. I do know this about your career, though. For almost a decade, if I'm not mistaken, you were the editor of the Christian Post. Am I right about this?
The politics editor, and then also for some time the opinion editor, and also I started there as a reporter.
Okay, tell our listeners. Most of our listeners will not know what the Christian Post is. I do, because I do read it. Tell us what the Christian Post is and where you would locate it on the landscape of journalism in America.
So it is an online daily news publication. It's evangelical, and it's been around since about 2005, I believe. So it's one of the younger evangelical publications. But unlike some other publications that started as like magazines and so forth, this one was always, from its beginning, an internet publication, internet based. At the time I was there, I know most months we were the leading evangelical publication in terms of number of hits, amount of internet traffic per month. Also, they have other editions in other languages, Spanish, Chinese, Portuguese, and others. So it's a global company as well.
And how would you position it vis-a-vis Christianity Today or any of the more secular stations, platforms, or even in relation to Charisma magazine and website? Help our listeners understand that. Help me understand it.
Well, so it's an interesting question because, as you know, I quit in December because of a pro-Trump editorial. So when I was there, it was, as far as politically, we very much wanted to cover the full range of views from the evangelical community, and that was a big part of our focus. And then in December, when Mark Galley came out with his op-ed in Christianity Today that got a lot of attention, it was sort of an anti-Trump editorial. And then the Christian Post wanted to write a response that was a pro-Trump editorial, and I just could not support that. And so I basically quit my job on the spot when that happened.
Were you the editorial or the opinion editor at the time?
No, I had stopped doing that about a year prior to that. Although I did continue to help with the editorial page. I was one of three main page editors, and so we all sort of contributed and helped because we didn't have an opinion editor at the time. So we all sort of, helped out with that page. So I would solicit editorials for the opinion page. And interestingly, like the day before this happened, I had published an op-ed critical of Trump. And that was one thing I was doing even when I wasn't the opinion page editor, was making sure that those voices critical of Trump were present on our op-ed page.
So as an staff person at the Christian Post, which I do read and occasionally take news stories from for my own summary of the news, because they will cover stories that Christianity Today does not cover, that Religion News does not cover, that Charisma does not cover. So who made the decision? Who, when you say that the Christian Post published this editorial, this opinion piece promoting Donald Trump, who makes a decision like that? Who owns the Christian Post?
I'm drawing a blank on his name. So we had just got a new owner about 6 months prior to that. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank
on
his name.
Well, that's all right. So the owner, did he insist on having this editorial?
This is what I was told was, yes, the owner and Michelle Vu, who was like managing editor, I forget her position at the time, but it was her and the owner who wanted the editorial, and then they asked John Grano and Richard Land to write it. So, yes.
And so Richard Land, was whom I know, was he was one of the writers of that opinion,
yes,
column supporting Donald Trump. And it was written in response to some degree.
Right. And let me just clarify here. This was not just an op-ed that would go on the opinion page as showing lots of, you know, all the different opposing viewpoints. This was specifically an editorial saying this is the position of the Christian Post. This represents us as a company.
I see. And that was over the line. You couldn't handle that and you quit.
Right.
Well, you stood up for, I'm sure you've, that's been a big sacrifice for you for standing up for your convictions on this.
Yeah.
So the Christian Post then is firmly in the Trump camp. Do you follow what's happening on Charisma magazine and the Charisma website?
A little bit. From what I've seen, they tend to be even more pro-Trump than the Christian Post. That's my impression.
Yes, yes, they are. And because their owner has not only written a book, but about Trump and about why America needs Trump. And, of course, what I'm trying to sort out, having been most of my life what we would call a white Southern evangelical, I grew up a Southern Baptist. I'm not a Southern Baptist anymore. But I'm trying to determine what is it that the conservative movement really wants. And what you're telling me is that the conservative movement is trying to figure out where they go after Trump, A.T. Do you think it's going to revert back, or is there going to be another Trump-esque person to seize the leadership of the movement? Or is Trump going to continue to be the leader even if he's defeated this fall? What do you think?
Yeah, this is actually a question that a lot of conservatives have been debating and asking themselves, assuming that Trump loses in November, will he continue to have an influence, an outsized influence? And so the people who say yes make this argument. You know, he already has a lot of these people in his camp. And so you can think about this as a split between like ideological conservatism, people who like read Edmund Burke, you know, and
right,
like have this notion of what the proper role of government should be. And that ideology influences their policy views and so forth. So there's sort of that what we could call ideological conservatism. And then there's the cultural conservatism, which is more like the Trumpian, like, oh, we got to go out, we got to own the libs, and we're anti-immigrant, and those horrible protesters who are anti-racism, we have to oppose them as well, and build a wall, and yay NASCAR, and all this sorts of thing, guns, and all this sorts of cultural sort of symbolism that a lot of people just sort of gravitate towards because they see this and it's like, oh, those are my people. I want to be part of my people because they have sort of similar things that I do in life and so forth. So there's that sort of cultural conservatism as well. So what might happen post-Trump is that he's going to continue to have sort of this outsized influence. He might buy a media company. There's already been a lot of talk about that, having his own media company that, you know, all these sort of Trumpian conservatives are going to, you know, get all their information from this, you know, Trump network. And they're already like sort of siloed in sort of their own social networks and so forth. And so he'll continue to have sort of this influence among these sort of cultural conservatives.
What you're describing, of course, is a kind of tribalism. And I guess one final question that I have, do you see issues or causes or needs that the country has right now that can bring people together and counter this tribalism that is such a problem right now? What do you see? Are there issues? Is there a cause? Is the coronavirus an opportunity to pull the country together?
Gosh, I wish I could give you an optimistic answer. I mean, what we've seen with the coronavirus is people are dividing over that, even along political lines. So now even mask wearing has become like a cultural symbol of, you know, where you stand ideologically, even though, you know, it has nothing to do with that. It's just, you know, you wear a mask to prevent the spread of the virus. Why is that difficult? So, I mean, I wish the church would lead on that as far as bringing people together. That's what we really need. That's what I would hope as a Christian, is that the church would be a driving force and sort of breaking down those cultural differences and cultural barriers. And, you know, and maybe we're starting to see that now with the race issue and the protests, and sort of hopefully an awakening among white evangelicals about their history of racism and how a lot of their our theology, our church traditions and so forth is built upon a sin of racism and slavery, and we've adopted that and we failed to recognize that as part of our history and how that's corrupted our theology. So hopefully there's an awakening in, you know, in that area as well.
Well, I agree with you 100% on both of these issues, both the racial justice and racial solidarity and the coronavirus, places where we could be coming together as a country. I've been talking with Dr. Nap Nasworth. I'm in Brunswick, Georgia, and he's over there near Austin, Texas. I'll be back in just a minute with my commentary for the week. Now here is the American Spiritual Ensemble singing, "Walk together, children, don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the promised land." Four months ago, Ahmaud Arbery was murdered here in Brunswick, Georgia. That event lit a fuse that burned through Louisville and New York all the way to Minneapolis, there to ignite an international movement focused on racial justice. Millions have marched. A few have resigned positions. Policies have changed. Legislation has been introduced. Coalitions have emerged, and a new resolve courses through the citizenry of these United States. While our attention has been drawn to this wider drama, much of importance has happened right here in Brunswick. After 74 days of inaction by local authorities, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation seized control of the situation. It took them a mere 36 hours to arrest two of the perpetrators and a few weeks more to arrest the third. This past week, a grand jury indicted the three on multiple murder-related charges. During this period, the entire community organized in ways unseen in recent years. Marches, rallies, protests have become commonplace, led by an invigorated ministerial alliance. Reverend David Yarborough, pastor of the largest church in the county, a white evangelical congregation with multiple sites, took the floor at an early meeting and declared, "This is about all of us." Their persistence focused initially on the passage of a state hate crime law. Georgia was one of only four states in the Union to not have such a statute on the books. That changed on June 19 when Governor Brian Kemp signed into law just such a bill. The state legislature also passed three laws that allows us as a county to vote on the future of our police force. The department has a checkered history, one that had the current police chief on administrative leave at the time of the Ahmaud Arbery murder due to pending charges of corruption. Quote, "There have been issues with the department through the years in our county," end quote, Georgia State Senator Bill Ligon said recently. He was explaining his crusade to authorize the referendum. If successful in November, the vote would empower us, Glynn County, to join the majority of Georgia counties in operating under one law enforcement agency, the sheriff, rather than two. June 9th was primary day in Georgia. 18,790 ballots were cast by Glynn County residents. That's at least 30% higher than normal voting in a primary. Hotly contested were four of the seven county commissioner seats. The other three are scheduled for a vote in 2 years. Of those four, one incumbent did not run for re-election. Two were defeated, and one, the only black commissioner, ran unopposed. This significant turnover reflects, in part, a discontent in the way the commissioners have handled matters of public safety and justice. Then there is that statue. A few blocks from the old town center lies the spacious Hanover Square. It was laid out by city founder and first Georgia governor, General James Oglethorpe, in 1771. At one time, it housed the stockyards, the courthouse, and the jail. In 1902, 37 years after the surrender at Appomattox, a 20-foot white stone monument was unveiled. A marble statue of a Confederate soldier adorned the top, his head slightly bowed, quote, "not in defeat or disgrace, but in dignified reflection," end quote, the dedicatory program read. That dignity is now being challenged, not only here in Glynn County, but in places public and private all over the country. Our current city commissioners, led by the mayor, Harvey Cornell, have promised to appoint a committee of citizens to advise them on what to do with the statue. Somebody already sent their recommendation in the form of black paint and the words, "Black Lives Matter." Mayor Cornell, himself a black man, in year 7 of his second 4-year term, rebuked the defacement, cleaned the monument, and promised to fine anyone who further defaces it. That is the only episode of vandalism in our now 4-month journey towards social justice and racial solidarity here in the Southern County, where, on February 23rd, a racially charged murder lit the fuse that ignited the largest national protest movement in 50 years. We have made good progress on these things, but other significant matters like education, employment, poverty, and health care await our attention. We have a long road. And that reminds me of the chorus to that wonderful spiritual, "Walk together, children, don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the promised land." You have been listening to The Meeting House, coming to you over Rejoice975.com from the Golden Isles of Georgia, Brunswick, Georgia, to be exact. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm always glad to hear from you. Let me know that you're listening and tell me what you think. You can email me at dwight@themeetinghouse.net, or you can post on my Facebook page, text me or call me if you've got my phone number, and many of you do. I want to thank the engineer, Everett Armstrong, and his associate, Alan Moody. Thanks to my special guest, Dr. Nap Nasworth. Thank you very much for coming on The Meeting House today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, you can tell that there's a whole lot more that we could be talking about, and this is going to be right at the center of national conversation for a long time. And you and I both, as religious people, as devout people, are very concerned about the way religion, the way Christianity is perceived, the way it functions, the way it's co-opted by political parties. There's a lot for us to talk about, and maybe we'll have more conversation about this. Blessings to you out there in Texas. I want to tell you, if you want to listen to the show, Nap, or any of your friends do, we rebroadcast this show at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday, and you can listen through the website at rejoice975.com. Thank you for joining us today in The Meeting House. I am your host, Dwight A. Moody. Be safe out there. Do justice. Sing a gospel song. Wash your hands, wear a mask, love mercy, stay home. Listen to what's being spoken all around you. Hear what the concerns of people are. Be kind to everyone. Subscribe to The Meeting House. Follow me on Twitter at Dwight A. Moody. I hope you have a great day, and you can join us next week in The Meeting House for another conversation on religion and American life. I'm your host, Dwight A. Moody.